Hello there, friends. I'm your host, Kendra Winchester, and this is Read Appalachia, a podcast celebrating Appalachian literature and writing. And this is episode 25, where we are featuring a live recording at Western Carolina University featuring Ron Rash and Dan Pancake. So I am coming to you from my office with a bit of a cold, so we're just going to push through. And I am so excited to talk to you about today's episode. Now, we kind of swapped it this month. We did Poetry Corner first, and we did a full-fledged Poetry Corner theme for April, as it is National Poetry Month in April. So our second episode is, it's kind of swapped. So we did a live recording at Western Carolina University for this episode as well. But this was a month after the Poetry Corner that you previously, hopefully, listened to. And this was at the Spring Literary Festival, which had so many incredible events. And so when Jeremy B. Jones, who asked me to do this event, I was over the moon excited. And I mean, I still can't believe it. So we did a recording there, and the folks at Western Carolina University recorded it for us. And there will be, I think, some video and photos that'll be coming out from Western Carolina University. So keep an eye on Read Appalachia's socials for those. So this is a full-length episode, and we do a little introduction for the live recording. So I'm just going to leave it there and let the recording take it away. So this is my conversation with Ron Rash and Ann Pancake.
Well, hi, I'm Kendra Winchester, and I have Read Appalachia, which is celebrating Appalachian literature and writing. We've had a lot of guests. You can see, you saw that they were several different guests, like Crystal Wilkinson, Nima Avashia, David Joy, and now the wonderful Ron Rash and Ann Pancake. So I thought I would start by introducing, and then we'll have some readings, and then we'll go into questions. I am very honored to be able to kind of facilitate this conversation today about two writers whose works I think often speaks to each other in different ways. So, all right, the bios. Ron Rash is the author of the Penn Faulkner finalist, the New York Times best-selling novel Serena, in addition to the critically acclaimed novels The Risen, Above the Waterfall, The Cove, One Foot in Eden, Saints at the River, and The World Made Straight. Five collections of poems and seven collections of stories, among them Burning Bright, which won the 2010 Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, Nothing Gold Can Stay, a New York Times bestseller, and Chemistry and Other Stories, which was a finalist for the 2007 Penn Faulkner Award and In the Valley. Three times the recipient of the O. Henry Prize, his books have been translated into 17 languages? I think that's cool. It must be... I love different book editions, but I'll spare you from my publishing nerding. He teaches here at Western Carolina University. Ann Pancake is a native of West Virginia. She's published two short story collections, Giving Ground and Me and My Daddy Listened to Bob Marley, and a novel, Strange as This Weather Has Been, which is one of the Kirkus Review's top 10 fiction books of the year, won the Best Appalachian Book of the Year, and was a finalist for the Orion Book Award and the Washington State Book Award. She also received She also received a Whiting Award and an NEA grant, a Pushcart Prize, and the Bakeless Prize. Her stories, essays, scholarly articles, and journalism have appeared in venues like Orion, the Georgia Review, Manoa, Poets and Writers, the Journal of Appalachian Studies, and News Stories from the New South, the year's best. She lives in Preston County, West Virginia. So please give us a warm round of applause for our two guests today. So we are going to start with readings. Any volunteers who would like to go first? I'll go ahead. We'll go alphabetically today.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It's great to see you. It's great to be here. My partner and I came in on Friday to, because I haven't been in this area since I was probably 5 or 6, and we've just had a wonderful time both being outside and also meeting people here and being around the warmth and hospitality here. So so thank you all, and thank you for coming. I'm going to read the first pages of a new novel I'm working on. I'm going to read a longer version tonight, but this is, I've only read this one place, which was a very small venue before. So, and it's not published. I'm probably not going to finish this, not, hopefully by the end of the year, but I'm not going to really give you context because this is, these are the very first pages. This is like the prologue. And the name of the novel right now is Canoes Trees. Is this mic, am I getting away from the mic, or is it okay? It's cool, okay, all right. Canoes Trees. My father taught me how to read the river when I was 6 years old. We put the canoe in a couple miles upstream of the house, there at the Polling's farm with the giant pigs on the loose. And for me, that'd be the scariest part, wading around those monster hogs in the shallows. We paddle on down to the long, still pool they called the GoDaddy because somebody's goats had gone feral in the sandstone cliffs above it. And after the GoDaddy came the Swishing Riffle. At least that was my dad's name for it. We found the last live mussels in that knee-deep riffle, big as saltwater clams, the lips of them almost sharp on your thumb and the secret sliver of silvery flesh. The water flushing through them, my father said, that's why they survived, the eternal motion of the current through them. He put me in the front of the canoe and directed me from the stern. Don't sink that blade all the way to the handle. Water hump like that, you got a rock under it. Look for the V, look for the V. For the 3 miles between Polling's and our house, the river mostly pushed gentle through cornfields and pastures, the heaved hills standing back a little, the tall mountains behind them. My orange life jacket so big it chafed under my ears, mildewed canvas smell, and the scrape and muted knock of my paddle against the aluminum canoe. My father taught me how to canoe. The canoe taught me the river. My brothers, Paul and Hanley, Dad taught them too, and they liked it, but neither was ever captured by the river like I was. We'd all load the canoe in the back of the pickup, then us kids climb in for ballast, the end jutting out over the road with a red rag tied to it. I was the oldest no matter how young I was. So once we put in, I always sat forward, scouting for the best way to pass through the currents, look for the V. Paul and eventually Hanley sat on the floor between the struts, throttled up to their cheeks in their own life jackets. Dad made us learn it all, how to change seats without tipping it, how to climb in from water over our heads, how to flip the canoe upright when capsized, first from where we could touch bottom and then from where we couldn't. We wore old tennis shoes to protect our feet from broken glass, because that was our river too. The trash and pesticides, the slime, the big clots of algae below the cow pastures. We got ear infections many summers, occasionally boils on our legs or arms. Body of water, body of child, we loved that river anyway. Like I said, when I was little, I learned to read the river on flattish water upstream of the house. But natural water in West Virginia is rarely still for very long. As you paddled closer to our farm looking north, you saw the land change. The ridges suddenly pulled in closer and the mountains reared up from the water. Beyond our house, the land went tight and tall, a steep narrow passage, but with little sharpness and hardness. The sides of it really too gentle to call it a canyon, too long, 8 miles to call it a gap. I don't know what Native people called it, but if a white woman had named it, she might have said cradle. And if I'd named it, I'd have said canoe. But white men named it so it was known as the trench. Our dad, he called it the throat. Until we grew up, we called it that too. In the throat, the water got wilder, the rocks got bigger, the currents got trickier. About the throat, I'd heard stories from earliest memory, and as soon as I learned to paddle, I started pestering my father. When can we go through the throat? What about this summer? How come I have to wait? He'd just shake his head. Not yet. Not until you get a little older and a little better at reading the river. Then we can go.
as if y'all haven't seen me enough around here. Yeah, Anne's one of my heroes. She's done so much great work, environmental work. I hope y'all know that. If you don't, you should find out more about it, as well being a wonderful prose writer. So I thought I would connect. I feel like one thing we connect is our interest in the natural world. And a few years ago, I read an article where traditionally in India, when people have undergone trauma or severe mental stress, that they will be sometimes they will be put beside a river, sometimes even bound, and lay there for hours, and it would begin to heal them. And that stayed with me. And in my novel, Above the Waterfall, I have a young woman, a park ranger named Becky. And when she was a child, she was actually at her school, there was a shooting, and she actually saw her teacher killed. And after that, she became mute and was unable to speak. They took her to psychiatrists. The parents couldn't figure out what to do, so they finally let her stay with her grandparents, who just let her roam the woods, and she gradually began to heal. And what she began, she recognized that she had to have this real deep connection to nature. It kind of grounded her. It kept her from going back into that trauma. So she almost invented a new language for herself to just stay as close to the world as possible, and also ultimately to try to teach children something that she had learned. But in this scene, she actually is out in the woods at evening at the park, but she's also thinking about Lascaux, and that's the caves that are in Europe, in France, probably 30,000 years old. But what's interesting at the cave art is that animals dominate, and she thinks about that too in this little scene. I'm going to read this in a couple of short passages. Though sunlight tinges the mountains, black leather-winged bodies swing low. First, fireflies blink languidly. Beyond the meadows, cicadas rev and slow like sewing machines. All else ready for night except night itself. I watch last light lift off level land. Ground shadows seep and thicken. Circling trees form banks. The meadow is like a pond filling. On its surface, dozens of black-eyed Susans. I sit on ground cooling, soon dew damp. Near me, a moldboard plow long left. Honeysuckle vines twine green cords, white flowers attached like Christmas lights. I touch a handle slick from wrist shifts, sweaty grips. Memory of my grandfather's hands, calluses round and smooth as worn coins. One morning I'd watched him cross the field, the still ore rippling soil. In its wake, a caught wave of cillian shine. But this plow has wearied into sleep. How long lying here? Perhaps a decade since saplings and sawbriar rise amid broom sedge. Above all else, those bold yellow blossoms in full petaled bloom. What has brought me here? A deer emerges from the woods, nose up, stilt step, then steadying paws. Another hoof lifted. Dark rises around me. The black-eyed Susans float like water lilies. All else disappears, but they hold their yellow glow. Moon mirrors, sun ghosts, dreams obey it. When the night pond floods its banks, I walk the trail to the state park truck. Lascaux, what wonder to have made such a descent? Tar pitch, torch wood, swabbing stone with light. Swerves and drops and slant downs, dark rushing up behind each step, then to find them there in the cave's hollow core, bison and ibex, but others lost elsewhere to the world, saber cats and woolly mammoths, Irish elk, all live motioned in the wavering light, girthed by curves of stone, amid it all the runic human handprint. Where art's less veil between us and the world? How strange, envisioning before seeing, but the first message there inside the cave walls, what wonder yet echoes from the world's understory? And she's actually in the park in this one. a red-winged blackbird saying, "Away from me, keep, away from me, keep," as he commandeers a cattail masthead, ebony coat blazoned with red epaulets fringed white. Above the drainage pond, Galax's skunky scent. Near the stream, cardinal flowers bloom. I touch a petal, some moisture yet. I check the campsites, then head back to the ridge. I set both arms on the railing, look down. Always a dizzying raft feel first. Wood and water both moving. Then only water as the bridge staples to the banks. Months pass their name, mayflies emerge. Brief lives spent aloft. They drift down light as dandelion spores. A brown trout sips one off the surface. Beneath the trout, mica-flecked sand gleams white. Come fall, the female's caudal fin will nudge the grains to make a nest, her eggs spilling pearls into a purse. The trout rises and curves, rose molds on its flank. A water snake bank blended until now, unspools into the water, prow-headed as it swims across, rest in the opposite shallows. On its back, inscape of dark brown saddle marks with thin pyramids of yellow. Last week, a man brought one into the office, two children in tow. Killed a moccasin, he bragged. I'd shown the children how viper's head differed, explained why all snakes were needed, including the venomous ones. This snake swivels downstream, a current within a current, soon under the bridge. And here she is. She actually takes some children out, third graders, and she has them come. And one of her favorite writers is Hopkins, who's so connected to the natural world, if you've read him. So she wants to bring them into the world. School bus arrives. I put the notebook back in my office and lead them downstream to a small waterfall where I recite Hopkins. A wind puff, bonnet, a foam froth, turns and twindles over the broth. You don't have to understand the words I tell them. Just let the sounds enter you. The same as everything else you see and smell and touch today. I show them deer and beaver tracks, some wildflowers and insects, before we walk up the meadow where we can all sit down. No breeze, early fall stillness like a carousel paused. The children feel it too, speak in whispers. What does silence look like? I ask them to think about an answer. As they do, several children tilt their heads to one side, listening. It looks like air, a child says. What else does it look like, I ask. It looks like night, but not scary. It looks like the wind when the wind's not blowing. What about you, Miss Douglas, a child asks the teacher. How about that it looks like paper that hasn't been written on? Plain paper with no lines, a child says. Yes. The teacher agrees, no lines. And what about you, a child asked me. Like stars resting on a calm pond.
Well, thank you both for those. They're beautiful. I could sit here and listen for ages. But today we are going to be talking about Appalachian literature and our authors' two experiences with Appalachian literature. With Read Appalachia, for me, it was very important to celebrate Appalachian literature as a literary tradition, its unique ideas, and the people who make all of that happen and their thoughts on the world that we live in. We're going to move to the questions portion, and we're going to start with really, I think, a fundamental idea is, what is Appalachian literature?
First of all, that was a beautiful reading. I'm so honored to get to it, because we've never read together. This is fantastic. Well, I think there are different ways to answer it. I think you could think about it geographically. It's usually how I think about it. But I see Appalachian literature as literature written by people who have perspective from inside Appalachia, as opposed to people who are writing sometimes from outside Appalachia without any kind of intimate knowledge of Appalachia. If we talk about and I see the states or the regions or the areas that are in the most Appalachians really from West Virginia down to North Georgia, so East Tennessee and East Kentucky and here and southern Ohio, maybe a little bit of Southwest Pennsylvania. I also say that there are very different Appalachias within Appalachia, that there are also threads that connect us and similarities among all of our writing. And I think one of those similarities is sense of place and attention to natural world. I think sense of maybe feel of place and attention to natural world. Also, we're very fortunate in Appalachia all over, I think, to have a really strong storytelling tradition, not in a kind of conventional, I'm not thinking about people sitting on the porch and telling conventional, like we think about sort of a stereotype of, but people here still know how to tell a story. I lived in Seattle for a long time. They don't know how to tell a story. They don't know how to build up. They don't know how to, you know, they just don't know how to do it. They don't know how to show. They don't know how to build up to a climax. And we're hearing stories all the time from, and a lot of it's just, you would call it gossip, right? But, you know, wreck stories and hunting stories and flood stories. So we have that. I also kind of identify a characteristic of Appalachian literature is in Appalachia, most parts of it, we have, I think, a beautiful and inventive language that I find more better material to work with than standard English. I think, you know, at the same time, we have to be a little careful with how we use it. But I've found that material as for my lyricism and my writing and a lot of other, as Ron was reading other writers in Appalachia, I think our lyricism comes partly from our native language, so to speak. So those are a few ways I think about it.
I would say two things. I want to talk about language, but also the idea of the physical landscape. But as far as the language, I think what I find interesting about folk languages, whether it's Gullah on the South Carolina coast or Appalachian, is that it's very connected to the natural world. But I think sometimes what people don't get about it is the inventiveness of it. The delight in language. For instance, I tell this story a lot, but when I was about 16 years old, my uncle was a tobacco farmer, and I was up in near Boone, and he and I went to Boone to the hardware store, and young woman, I'm sure an Appalachian student, came walking down the street summertime. And she was very scantily clad by my uncle's standards. And he saw me looking at her. And he turned to me and he said, "That girl hasn't got enough clothes on to wad a shotgun." Now, when I went back when I was in graduate school, we were trying to decide what made poetic language. And everything we talked about kept coming back to my uncle in that line. And to me, that's what I love, that kind of inventiveness. And I think Anne makes a really good point that you have to be really careful, because it can sometimes come off, if you're not careful, like Snuffy Smith. It just comes into this where and I think one way that I try to show the sophistication of the language is through simile. Because if you can't create a good, you know, a simile takes intelligence, because you're taking two unalike things, whether it's clothes and a shotgun, and you're suddenly yoking them together. So that's a big part of it. The other part, I mean, one aspect I would talk about that I've been very interested in for years is what's called cultural geography. What is it about mountain people around the world, whether it's in Africa, Europe, South America, that connects us? And one thing that's been kind of interesting to me is that I will get sometimes emails or letters from people in other mountain cultures, whether India or Europe, and they talk about how they can connect to what I'm writing about. because in a sense they understand the landscape, the way the light comes in, what it's like to live in a hollow. And another aspect I found very interesting in my own family, and I think there's something I'm running with it too much, but it does obsess me, is how does landscape fit our perception of the world? What I've seen, and people tend to, I've noticed people in other places tend to agree with this. The mountains can either be a sense of what, of making us feel so small that we can almost become fatalistic. We feel almost powerless. You see the eons of these, and yet they're looming over you. But the other side of that is that they can be very nurturing and womb-like. I think that kind of complexity, that sense of those visions is something that I think certainly how the landscape, the mountain landscape affects the people.
I always love hearing authors talk about the things about Appalachia that they find and that they treasure and that recurs in their writing, and often books are talking to each other and in that way. And I love what you said about mountain people around the world. There's so many universalities and similarities. Part of this project of Read Appalachia is to share Appalachian literature, yes, with other Appalachian people, but also people outside the region to kind of start that process, those conversations. We've all talked to someone from outside the region that had certain assumptions about what Appalachia is like. And when it comes to Appalachian literature, what do you think that people often misunderstand about it?
I'll go. That's fair. I know Anne would agree with me, and I've read her work, so I know. I think there's a if our characters come off as mere exotics, we failed as writers. If that's all they are, and I think one thing I'm very aware of, and I think this kind of ties into what you were saying earlier about how people outside might write about the region as opposed to people inside, and I think to me it's the difference between what I would call regional writing and local color. Local color writing, I think you're emphasizing what makes the place different. What does make it exotic? You're kind of looking in, I think what I consider regional writing, and I would say James Joyce's Ulysses is as regional a novel as I know, 24 Hours in Dublin. Regional writing, we capture something of the place. We try to be as much fidelity to the place and the people as possible. Yet ultimately, it's an attempt to, if we go deep enough, like farmers drilling for water, that we're going to hit what it means to be a human being. A human being not just in North Carolina or West Virginia, but somewhere else, anywhere in the world. And that's the writing I think I value the most. And I think, I'd just be interested in what you think about it, Dan.
Well, I think... How was it phrased? What do people misunderstand about Appalachian literature? I think I get frustrated because I think a lot of people who are not from Appalachia come with, and this is kind of what you're saying, a certain set of expectations about what we in this region write about. And I also feel that sometimes publishers want that formula or that picture too. So if you disrupt it enough, it makes it sometimes more difficult to reach a wider audience because you can't get that publication. But I think your word fidelity is really, I see in my students too, I really encourage people who are writing about Appalachia to write what you're actually seeing and experiencing instead of write what you read through somebody else's lens, or not even just read, but saw in some in media or the way people talk about Appalachia. Try as hard as you can to see it through your own eyes and write about your own experience instead of someone else's filtered. Sometimes we see our world filtered through the way other people have written about it or talked about it. And I also get frustrated. I think absolutely some of the best writing in the United States comes out of Appalachia. And I think there's sometimes an assumption from outside that we are a It's good for being from Appalachia, right? Like it's good writing for someone from West Virginia, but not necessarily if you compare it to the other writers in the nation. And I think that is so very wrong, that the assumptions they have that way. I agree with what Ron says about drilling, because I think, again, some of the assumptions expect a caricature, and a caricature is where you haven't drilled, right? That's just the surface. You're giving a surface representation that maybe the audience found familiar, so likes. But to do a good job as an Appalachian writer is to take that so-called caricature and drill deep. Because if you look at people that were around, people in my family, my neighbors, yeah, if you just wrote them that way, that shallow way, they fulfill the stereotype. You can do it that way. It's not that it was completely invented out of thin air, but they're not only that. And so the responsibility of the Appalachian writer is to write them as human beings and to go much deeper than the way that they're often represented in works about Appalachia that are more shallow. So those are.
We lost a great Appalachian writer just a couple of months ago, Fred Chappell from Canton. And he said something that has stayed with me, and I think it's what the literature I admire really does. He said that one thing literature had taught him was to never trust his first impression. And I think a good writer does that very thing.
There are so many wonderful things about Appalachian literature that I always want to share with other people. And sometimes people will be just shocked, like, wait, people write books in Appalachia? Like, do they, I don't know how many times people have asked if people in Appalachia actually read. And it lights a fire under you. It's not the great feeling, and that's why these conversations are so important.
I've got a great story about that. Actually, I think several people over here are going to know it too. We had a couple of people from New York or Los Angeles come to Western to enlighten us a few years ago about film and other things. And I was eating lunch with one of them one day, and he said, I was mentioning a writer I really admire who's from Tasmania, and he just won the Booker Prize, a really good writer. And he was asking me what I'd been reading, and I mentioned this guy's book, The Narrow Road to the Long North, just wonderful book. And he kind of said, Tasmania. And he said, isn't it amazing? Writers sometimes they can come from anywhere. Look at you.
I mean, I'm not surprised. I have a
similar story. I have a number, but this is so, and this might resonate with some of you here because I live right now more in a mining industrial part of West Virginia. I mostly grew up in an agricultural area, which is only 100 miles from Washington, D.C. So in my home county, the population has doubled over the last 30 years from retirement and second home people from the D.C. area. I don't know how it is here, but they usually have their own alternative world that they're running alongside the world of everybody I know there. But I gave a reading there, I think it was the library at some point, and this guy came up to me who was one of these people who'd moved from Washington but said he substitute taught at my high school. And so he said, where'd you go to high school? And I said, I went to Hampshire High School. And he said, There's no way you went to Hampshire High School. I substitute there. There's no way that the way you write, you could have come out of that high school. And so that's one. I've also heard, this is another one that you'll love. I'll just have to say it real quick. I was talking to an agent. This is when I was pretty young, and I walked in the room and they said, "How do you know so much about rednecks? You don't look like a redneck." So, so these kind of things happen quite a bit to us.
I love when Appalachian writers sit down and talk about these things, because everyone has so many of these stories, and that is why Read Appalachia, like I said, exists and why it's so important for these conversations. And I keep thinking about how wonderful all these Appalachian writers that I keep talking to are, and I keep getting frustrated that people are missing out. People don't realize how
you know, some of the best literature in the country is coming from this region. And I think people are now slowly, with the dawn of the internet, have begun being able to find more of these books and more reading them to be able to read them more. And that's something that I really love to see. And I have so many supportive folks from around the world who are like, oh, really? I'll read a book. And that's really great to see people support Appalachian authors in that way. And so, but it wasn't really always that way. I wanted to ask both of you, when you first started writing, when you started putting your work out into the world, did you realize that you were writing in some sort of Appalachian literary tradition? Or were you just like, I'm going to do this thing here, I will put it out into the world?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I started writing when I was in grade school, but then really seriously in high school, and I've heard of Appalachia. I consider myself a West Virginian just because that's how we identified. And I think my attitude towards being from West Virginia was I have to get out of here to find anything to write about because it's very boring here. And that's a whole other story. But no, I did not consider myself Appalachian, and I wasn't writing for an audience. I was just trying to tell stories and really listen to the voices and stuff. So yeah.
I think it's interesting. When I was about, I guess, fifth grade, I found a Jesse Stewart reader, and Jesse Stewart's a Kentucky writer, and the language that he used, I'd heard that language, and I think that had a big impact. And as I got older, I read Wilma Dykeman, Harriet Arnow, James Steele, Stewart, and so those writers had a real impact. But I was also reading Faulkner, and I read Faulkner young, and I think that was a good person to read because what he was able to do was to show that you can write about this small rural area and really make great literature. I think he did was a great example of that. So I think those writers certainly had an impact on me.
Yeah, Faulkner too has had a huge impact on me. I read in college, but until I went to college, I didn't know of any writers in West Virginia except for Pearl Buck, who only wrote, lived in China from the time she was 1 year old. But I don't know if I knew of any Appalachian writers. I definitely didn't know of any West Virginia writers, so I didn't have a model for that we could do this. And I thought I had to leave to be able to do this. And I continued to in West Virginia. We have less infrastructure in West Virginia than some of the Appalachian states have for literature. We don't have many publishers. We have very few literary journals. We don't have the kind of retreats and residencies and conferences some of the other states have. So I continue to be, to try as hard as I can to encourage young West Virginians, because many times they might have heard of an Appalachian writer who's not from West Virginia. But anyway, so my influences when I was real young were not from inside the region. And then once I discovered them, and the first people I discovered were Breece Pancake and Jane Ann Phillips. And they're like 10 years older than I was, and they were really successful. So that gave me confidence that, yeah, you can come from here and actually write about here and succeed here. So.
And as, this writing, more and more people have put their art out into the world, and there have been so many new Appalachian writers. I feel like I'm getting emails about more Appalachian writers every week, and that is phenomenal to see. What are some of the changes that you've seen in the Appalachian literary scene that you'd like to share?
Well, yeah, I mean, what's interesting, I think, is sometimes whether it's the Renaissance in England or the South in the 20s or the Harlem Renaissance, that once something starts gaining momentum in a region, it tends to more and more writers realize, well, I can do this too. And I think that's what's happened. I think a lot of that has to do with Lee Smith, great writer, I think Robert Morgan and Fred Chappell, those writers have all been very important. But yeah, it's opening up. And I mean, there are areas, there is an urban Appalachia. I mean, there is, that's a world. We have writers, different writers from different backgrounds. One of my favorite short story writers is Crystal Wilkinson, wonderful short story writer. I actually talked one of her stories last week. Annette Clapsaddle is certainly, and I think sometimes you might want to say, well, you know, that's great that we have these different voices. The thing that matters is they're so damn good. I mean, you know, they're great writers. And so certainly those, I think, you know, certainly David Joy, Mark Powell, these, you know, we've got a number of writers. But also I like, you know, I think something that's happening is probably more, it seems to be more push for the environmental now. I think that's a kind of a newer aspect that we're really starting to get a sense of that. I mean, you've worked on it a while, and I know there have been other books about coal mining, but those kinds of issues, but with global warming. So I think that's become more important, too.
Yeah, I would agree, and I'd like to see even more of it. But I know in West Virginia, we're really seriously in a post-coal, post-industrial phase right now, although a lot of people like to pretend that we're not. And I see people, you know, in their 20s that are seeing beyond that post-industrialism and trying to imagine something beyond it in the natural world. And I'm very moved by what they're doing. There's a new book that will be coming out by a poet named Torley Bush, in October, from Pulley Press. There's a new press in Seattle y'all should know about, which is being, I think, funded by someone from Microsoft. But the purpose is to publish rural poetry. So they found Torley in West Virginia and are publishing that. Another poet who has not had a book out yet but will is Mary Lindscheid, and the way she writes about the natural world is I'm very interested in their point of view, because I think when I was writing about environmentalism when I was in my 30s, I to be honest with you, I had a kind of hope for change and for preservation of certain parts of the natural world, that now I'm thinking about how to write to be with the issues and the places and really the destruction in the natural world, especially in West Virginia, that we're dealing with right now. And they have come straight into that as children and are able to see it in a way that I couldn't back then, but still be, optimism's not the right word, but generative and creative and flexible and resourceful. I think something that Ron was saying about, you know, the mountains feeling like they're embracing but also oppressive. I think in Appalachian literature, and especially in West Virginian literature, there's a lot of paradox, because a lot of us there, it's such a beautiful place, and its other parts are just like the ugliest place you've ever seen because of destruction. And we have a very deep love-hate relationship with it. And I think when we're working from such extremes of emotion or perception, that makes good art. Like that tension in there makes passionate art. And that's certainly true about the natural world in West Virginia, because really I have a line, and I don't know where, it might be in this novel, where nowhere are God made things more beautiful or man made things more ugly. And that's how I feel about West Virginia and the natural world. But I'm excited about where these younger writers are going with that.
Yeah. And that idea of conflict. I don't know. It's either Graham Greene or Orson Welles said that the Swiss have had 600 years of peace and prosperity, and all they've given us is the cuckoo clock. And so, you know, for a writer, if you're in a place where filled with contradictions and angst, you know, that's going to help you a lot. But I think the other thing, and this is something I really admire about Anne's work, and is that, you know, sometimes I get so tired of somebody saying, you know, that we need to stop these people from, you know, cutting wood or pulpwood, or we need to stop them from digging coal. And that's easy for us, because, you know, we're not the ones who, you know, have maybe a high school education, and this is the only job we're going to get that's going to make a really good salary. And I think one thing you've done in your work that I really appreciate is that you show that. I mean, you don't just say it's not that easy. These people do have lives, and so I've always, you know, admired that. And I tried to do a little bit of that in my novel Serena. I mean, I tried to show the workers, you know, because they were kind of trapped. You know, they're destroying their environment. They know it. Yeah. But they've also got families to feed. And that's where I really have a lot of problems, particularly when I listen to the national media, you know, this idea that, you know, these people, you know, why were you letting them do anything like that? What do we do? You know, it's almost like they're disposable.
There's a West Virginia writer, Nora Shalloway Carpenter, who's just published a book called Fault Lines, which deals with that for young adults. And she's also a more up-and-coming writer. So it was like seeing, you know, reading, you know, I've been going back in the backlist to read older works and then moving forward, the same themes about the environment, about the natural world. You know, Appalachian literature is so connected to place. And when place is being destroyed, that has just huge ramifications, and we're going to be feeling it for generations.
Yeah, there's a concept called solastalgia. Are you familiar with that, Ron? It was coined by an eco-psychologist in Australia, and he's playing on nostalgia, you know, but solastalgia is what happens psychologically to a person when they are in the present watching their place be destroyed, as opposed to, you know, responding to the past where maybe it was destroyed. And Albrecht, of course, is talking about indigenous people in Australia, but also what he calls it a form of second wave colonialism, because there are white people now who, like in Appalachia, this kind of goes back to what you're saying about the international mountain connection and mining connection, who are being displaced. As in Appalachia, white people displaced native people, then they were displaced by white people with more resources. But my point is that this concept of living in a place while you're watching it be destroyed and what that does to you psychologically and how you learn to live with it is, I think, becoming, it's always been a part of Appalachia, but I'm more conscious of it now. And it's not, another thing, one time the writer Barry Lopez said to me, what's already happened in Appalachia is now coming everywhere else. And I agree, too. And that's another reason that Appalachian literature is so valuable, because we've lived through a lot of the environmental devastation, also political changes that are now going other places.
Yeah, I've got a line in my third novel where I say landscape is destiny. And that, you know, just that idea that the landscape you're born in and what you're seeing and how you react to it, all that really ties into your sense of possibility.
So we've talked a little bit about where Appalachian literature has been, the ideas that are there. And we've touched a little bit on, like, the future of Appalachian literature, seeing newer writers. Is there something about the future of Appalachian literature that you're excited about or that you would like to see as it moves forward?
One thing that I worry about it moving forward is the homogenization of the culture and the language everywhere, but in Appalachia. So I worry a little bit about our literature becoming, like I don't know how to describe it, but like just general literature and dominant culture. However, I think what gives me hope are the things that we've talked about people, new writers treating the natural world, also the way that Appalachian literature is opening wider and wider to include all kinds of people who before were not even considered Appalachia because the stereotype are straight white people, you know. So I'm looking forward to more of those points of view. And another thing that, well, I'll let Ron go from there. So,
no, I think that covered it. Yeah.
I mean, one of the questions is, where's literature going? I mean, I think that's
that. Yeah, I mean, that. Well, that's
where's reading going?
That actually, I think, is a really important question. And I told my students a couple of weeks ago that, and this sounds pretentious, but I said, I think right now, the novel is probably as important as it's ever been, because it's about the last place you can go where you really have to have a long sense of real intense connection. It's not like the news you get. It's not like the internet. You know, it's not like your text. You've got to really immerse yourself in that. And I think personally that, you know, for a society to be healthy, you have to have that sense, because you're not going to be able to understand anything in depth if you don't.
I totally agree with Ron, and I think also the immersion in the novel is different from an immersion in a limited series or a movie, because of the access you have, the interiority of the characters in it, which you don't else. And we're in a culture that is moving farther and farther away from humanity and being human, and literature and art in general brings us back to humanity, and there's been no more important time for us to keep trying to pull the pendulum back in that direction. And I agree about the novel and as a form and how it's different from most other kinds of any kind of genre or media that we are exposed to.
I love what you said about the novel being so important. There's always an article that comes out like every 5 years that says the novel is dead. I'm like, oh, it's dead again. Okay, well, I just keep...
It's usually written by people who can't do it.
Well, we are about out of time. I have one last question for you. On the podcast, we talk a lot about heavy things and all sorts of things. So I always like to end on a note of talking about the books that we love. And so today I wanted to ask you, what is an Appalachian book that you wish you could read for the first time again?
There are a number. Bree's Pancakes Collection. I can only dream of reading that for the first time again. Jane Ann Phillips' Black Tickets, her first full collection. The Dollmaker. I mean, I think that book lived in me. I read it when I was probably 20 and lived in me forever. So I could keep going on and on, but I'll let Ron speak to it.
Oh, wow. Well, I think just my delight when I first read those Jesse Stewart Jesse Stewart stories. I mean, they're very often first person. They're in dialect, but they are about just life. And I mean, just amazing stories. And I actually, when I was teaching high school, I was teaching at a school near Salem, South Carolina, mountain school, right on the line, not far from here. And the kids were all, none of the kids, I don't think I had a student, maybe one student whose parents had been to college. And I would read those Jesse Stewart and Harry Cruz to them. And I could get them to behave and they got those. But I think if I had to pick a novel by an Appalachian writer I would love to read first time, it probably I Am One of You Forever by Fred Chappell. That is the most beautiful book. And it's actually really, I think it's groundbreaking. And we've talked about what the possibilities for Appalachian literature. That book employs a magical realism. I mean, he has this wonderful image early on when his mother and father have this really intense emotional moment, and the mother sheds a tear, and the tear starts enlarging and enlarging. And finally, it enlarges the child too. I mean, it's just breathtaking. I read it every semester to my students. That book, if you haven't read that book, you really, really should.
Well, all of those books will be linked in the show notes if you're listening to this after it's recorded. And folks can also find that in a few weeks. But thanks so much to both of you, Ron Rash and Anne Pancake, for recording with me today.
Thank you, Kendra. It's my pleasure.
Kendra, thank you for what you're doing. I mean, her broadcast has been really important for our region's literature. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Okay, friends, that's our show. A heartfelt thank you to Ron Rash and Dan Pancake for recording with me. A huge thank you to Jeremy B. Jones and the folks at Western Carolina University for arranging the recording. And if you would like to find the myriad of ways that you can support Read Appalachia or just check out the podcast and other things that Read Appalachia does, head over to readappalachia.com. You can find us across social media at Read Appalachia. You can find me on social media at KD Winchester. And be sure to join us next time for May's theme, which is photography. But until then, happy reading.